And we must have warned him 100 times. You do that one more time and you're out.
Oh! Look what you've done! I gotta have you!
40 grand!
I don't want your
40 grand!
I don't need your
40 grand!
All I've got is a
40 grand!
But it's not enough!
Obviously, I tried to, you know, play the guitar, and that wasn't happening at all. And that's when Mutt exploded at me. So, because of that, I turned around and I, you know, gave Mutt a mouthful back, and it just went downhill from there, really.
Pyromania. No question. Burn the building. Burn, burn, burn.
One of the best bands around, Def Leppard, is currently pummeling American record charts. Their song Photograph from their third LP, Pyromania, is currently number one across the board. And Rockline welcomes from Def Leppard, Joe Elliott. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Glad to have you here. We also have Steve Steeman Clark, one of the guitar players. Hi, Steve.
Good evening.
The newest member of Def Leppard, Phil Collin, joins us tonight. Hello, Phil.
Hello, how are you?
We have also Rick Savage, further known as Sav from now on. Hi, Rick.
I
should say, and the other Rick in the band, Mr. Rick Allen. Glad to have you here this evening.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You all right? Yeah. Hooray!
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and this is episode number 3 in my series on Def Leppard. We're going album by album here. 2 weeks ago, we talked to Joe Royland about On Through the Night. Last week, Julian Gill joined us about High and Dry, and this week I'm joined by author Greg Renoff to discuss Def Leppard's third album, Pyromania. Hey, Greg.
Hey, how are you, BJ?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I thought it would be great to give you an opportunity to talk about something other than Van Halen, because you must be pretty burned out at this point. I think I've heard you on every single podcast I listen to.
Yeah, it's going to be a little change of pace. It'll be fun.
You know, what a journey it's been. And, you know, again, congratulations on everything. And we'll look forward to what you come out with next, right?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been definitely a great ride over the last few months, and I'm certainly appreciative of everyone who bought the book and talked about the book. And of course, you were the first one to have me on a podcast way before the book came out, so I'm certainly grateful to you too.
But man, I heard you on Focus on Metal, and you were on Three Sides of the Coin, and the last one I heard was Danko Jones. You've really hit the circuit there. It's
yeah,
great.
Dank, it's been fun. Yeah, Danko Jones was a great one. He's a great guy and has a very he has a real interest in the lost Van Halen recordings, meaning not so much the songs they did with Roth or Hagar that never came out, but the stuff where Eddie would be locked in the studio with Don Landy for 3 days recording all this crazy music that never came out. You know, when Eddie would say in early 1985, I have enough material for 2 solo records. That's the stuff Danko was interested in. But anyway, we should talk about Def Leppard and not Van Halen. Don't get me started.
Yeah, let's not. Yeah. So anyways, we're here today to talk about Def Leppard's third album, Pyromania, which, you know, one of the biggest albums of all time. I'm sure everyone listening is very familiar with this record. When I talked to Joe Roiland about On Through the Night and then Julian Gill about High and Dry, we talked about how On Through the Night was made by a very young, very ambitious band, and then they swiftly came into their own on High and Dry and quickly went from having a lot of potential to just having a lot of confidence, and they sound like a completely different band, you know, between those two albums. And in my opinion, Mutt Lange's production work on High and Dry is pretty much perfect. I think it's one of the greatest sounding records ever, and I wouldn't really have any complaints about it. I would not say the same thing about Pyromania and the production on this one. The manager of Def Leppard from Q Prime, Peter Mensch, was quoted as saying, this must be from right before the album came out, he said, he called Pyromania the album that will redefine the term heavy metal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe for a while it did. I think it just kind of confused the issue. And in the end, it redefined Def Leppard as not a heavy metal band in a lot of people's eyes, I guess. And it's funny that Q Prime, you know, the year after this album comes out, they sign a new client called Metallica. And there's your band that's going to redefine the term heavy metal, yeah. Right? But yeah, it shows you how at the time Pyromania was made, everybody hadn't quite figured out yet what heavy metal was, and it was all kind of in flux, and it was this developing genre. I mean, it meant, you know, like you know, with Van Halen in the 70s, it meant one thing, but it really became convoluted in the 80s, and I guess there were a lot of arguments probably about what was and wasn't heavy metal, and yeah, Pyromania was definitely like a transitional album for sure in the genre. But now in retrospect, I think a lot of people wouldn't even think of Pyromania as heavy metal. But it definitely was at the time, and it's interesting that Peter Mensch was saying that. Like, this is the ultimate heavy metal album, you know, at the time when it was about to come out. So we can
get into this track by track, I know. But so tell me what your issue is with the production, I take it, of Pyromania, just generally.
Well, I love Pyromania. I've always loved it, but it definitely comparing it to High and Dry, obviously the main thing is the drums, which
right.
It's ironic that right here on this record, Mutt Lange has already converted Rick Allen over to electronic drums.
Right, right. They're like heavily triggered, and it just they don't sound at all. Well, I shouldn't say they don't sound at all. I don't think they sound very much like a drum kit that's sitting in a room.
They're not processed.
Yeah,
yeah. No, apparently Mutt Lange, you know, they say Rick Allen helped him program the drums, but, you know, who knows how much. Mutt Lange seems like he's probably a control freak when he has an idea. So, and obviously, you know, I don't think Rick Allen was happy about that. But even when this record is being made, I don't know if Rick Allen's he's barely 20 years old.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Joe Elliott tells the story of how Rick Allen is sitting there with just the cymbals, listening to the electronic drums and playing the cymbals along with the electronic drums. And I guess on the record, really the only thing that Rick Allen, you know, physically played was the cymbals, from what I've read.
Yeah, it from what I've read about the album, it seems like Lang's approach to Hysteria you know, it's all part of this natural evolution where he was making those guys replay, you know, a two-note riff over and over, you know, do it again, or like you're saying, a cymbal hit, like do it again, making, even breaking down the vocals, it sounds like, to, you know, they talk about, you know, comping vocals. It seems like the entire songs were comped. They were not at all, verses weren't sung. From what I could pick up about the production, Joe Elliott's vocals were not at all going to be, you know, him singing, you know, a verse and a chorus and them saying, okay, we'll keep the first verse and, or, oh, you know, this first two words are going to stay. It just seems like every single word almost was sung. That may not be 100% accurate, but that's what, at least what I got from reading, some interviews with Elliott and the other guys in the band. It was just very, very meticulous production, breaking things down to each individual piece and putting it together rather than thinking, well, I want to capture a great performance of this in the studio.
Yeah, I think Mutt Lange was sort of morphing into this eccentric genius with more and more emphasis on the first word. So, and I think, yeah, I think a big problem with his work on Pyromania is the eccentricities crept in there a lot more. High and Dry is just a raw, it just sounds great, but there's not so much fiddling and tinkering going on.
And it's sort of, you can understand why Pete Willis couldn't survive. It sounds like, from everything I know, that he was drinking a tremendous amount. And if you're in that situation where you're going to be spending these long hours in the studio where it's going to have to require long hours of attention to these incredibly meticulous details, you're not going to survive in that environment where, you know, if you're going to be fucked up half the time and, you know, strapping your guitar in backwards or passing out on the sofa in the studio and stuff like that, it's just not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. So the record was recorded January to November of 1982, and Pete Willis was fired in July of 82, so basically midway through the recording. And they already had Phil Collin in mind by the time they jettisoned Pete Willis. I have a quote from Joe Elliott where he says, "Pete was just becoming a liability. Basically, he turned into a drunken arsehole who couldn't do his job properly, right. So he had to go." Right. And, but I really, it seems like in the end it came down to Mutt Lange saying it's him or me. I think that was a big part of it.
Oh, sure.
Mutt and Pete really butted heads. And yeah, you know, it's a similar story to the dynamic between Bob Ezrin and Ace Frehley. You know, you get these producers that, in retrospect, Pete Willis seemed to have a serious drinking problem. But as far as the making of this record goes, I would think I side with Pete Willis in his disputes with Mutt Lange over just the obsessive nature of of making it. And yeah, you know, the band was never going to be the same without Pete Willis. And I mean, you know, we've seen where it's gone from there. And I also, I think I brought this up when I was talking to Julian at the end of the episode. I think we started talking about Pete Willis and I was saying, well, you know, the band, they were going to work with their drummer, their one-armed drummer, to keep him in the band, but they couldn't work with their guy with a drinking problem.
Sure. It's like Guns N' Roses. It's like Slash is shooting heroin, and they keep him in the band, but Adler is doing whatever, and they fire Adler because he's, you know, he's a liability. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's the same idea.
Yeah, if you go to later in their history and you look at some of their quotes about Rick Allen, you just say, well, why didn't you take the same approach with Pete Willis? But I think it was Mutt Lange was why they didn't.
Yeah. So. Well, and what's also somewhat surprising to me, but maybe that has to do with just how long it was taking them to make the record, is they didn't wipe Willis's rhythm guitar tracks. I think a lot of times in those situations, you know, you see this where they're like, well, they wiped the other guy's tracks away from the record, and they didn't do that. But from what I read, they kept his rhythm guitar tracks, and they didn't have Phil Collin play those tracks instead. So that's I would love to hear from Mutt Lange in an imaginary interview you and I would have with him, like, why didn't he wipe the tracks and go back to using, you know, putting the new guy and letting him play? But my just gut wonders if it's just they had put so much work into the other parts that they couldn't imagine going back to trying to fix them.
Yeah, and I think it's because the tracks were so good. And so Mutt Lange would have to admit that, well, yeah, he did a good enough job that we kept all his guitar on the album.
And, and sort of like,
So this record, Pete Willis played a major role in writing and recording Pyromania, but his name is not listed as a band member. So I think people forget that Pete Willis played a huge role in this record, and Phil Collin just played some guitar solos, and that's it. So,
and Pete had, let me see how many co-writes here. One, two, looks like three co-writes, if I'm looking correctly here. Yeah. Photograph, Too Late for Love, Billy's Got a Gun, and Coming Under Fire. Sorry, four co-writes. And Mutt Lang has co-writes on how many of them?
Probably two, most of them, right?
Yeah, three, four of them, yeah. You know, that's something else, too, that always is worth commenting on here, too, as well, that, you know, there are some producers who will take co-writing credits, and there's others who don't. I mean, they just, you know, they may – any producer worth his salt is contributing in some sort of way, I would think, to the song structures and, you know, in pre-production, these types of things, has ideas, anyone who's any good. But it's – I guess that the thing I read is that Joe Elliott said that they insisted that Mutt get a credit because he had put so much work into the songs that he deserved it. So it may not have been so much that, you know, Mutt was like, I deserve credit as much as the band member said, you do deserve it, which yeah, it was a real partnership there between producer and musicians, maybe beyond some of the others that are that don't require those writing credits in the end.
You know, the any issues I have with the production of Pyromania definitely don't hamper my enjoyment of the record. This is one of my very first favorite albums, and it's never stopped being one of my favorite albums. So, but you know, I would say, yeah, get rid of the electronic drums. That's a no-brainer. And, you know, maybe less keyboards, but, and some of these songs, like if we're going to get into the track by track here, if we start off with the first song, Rock, Rock Till You Drop, well, I would absolutely love to hear this song produced like High and Dry, mm-hmm. and sounding more like Let It Go, but not that I really have a problem with how it sounds here. It's a great song. This was actually evolved from an earlier song called Medicine Man, which played us out on the High and Dry episode, a live version of that. And it's much improved here from the early incarnation. I absolutely love this song, but yeah, great driving rock song. You know, I don't know what more to say about it. It's awesome.
Yeah, a great riff. And I think it, you know, the opening with the keyboards immediately establishes this is a new Def Leppard sound. You know, it's sort of, sorry for the Van Halen reference, but it's like when you put on 1984 for the first time, you hear the keyboards. It's immediately saying, this is a new iteration of our musical vision. It's something new. And I think that's the thing, like you're getting at with the keyboards. It's not, you know, that they sweetened up choruses with the keyboards. The keyboards and the electronic sounds were very much part of the sonic landscape of the album, very upfront, which, yeah, I mean, it may not have been to everybody's taste, but 10 million albums later, right, it's kind of hard to argue with the success. Of that, because it definitely, I think, made it, for whatever reason, you know, more 80s. I think that was sort of like more in the spirit of the times. Even though you and I could probably go, yeah, I prefer to have less. I listened to it too, and I go, yeah, less of the electronic drums, maybe less keyboards, less Thomas Dolby, right, on the keyboards, which is even funnier. Yeah. So,
Yeah, I don't know if Mutt Lang was following trends or trying to be a trendsetter with the way he approached producing this album. He obviously took a very, very different approach to this record than he did to High and Dry. And I'm not sure where he was coming from, but I think he was misguided in the end.
I was thinking about this morning, even with the AC/DC albums, can you imagine him coming in the studio and saying to Angus and Malcolm, hey, we're going to put some, you know, I'm going to bring Thomas Dolby in to play some synths underneath,
yeah, right.
You know, underneath the, put the finger on you or something like that. I mean, that was, so he, you know, he obviously thought this artist in particular must have been well fit for this type of change. And I think also it sounds like those guys had confidence in Lang to really, you know, they kind of laid this, he laid this idea out on them. We're going to make an album that's different than other rock albums, and it's something that's going to be innovative. And they obviously trusted him to do that.
Yeah, I think the band and Mutt had a similar vision. Maybe they weren't quite sure how to get there, and this, you know, they tried what they tried, and obviously it worked in terms of album sales. You know, it kind of you know, that's another thing about High and Dry is it doesn't really sound dated at all, and Pyromania does. Mm-hmm. So,
and yeah, and getting into, if you want to get into Photograph, that's a Pete Willis songwrite as well, but also it's to me one of the reasons why the album does stand up, even though there's some things that sound dated to me, is the songs are so good. In all seriousness, I think an album that had Photograph and Foolin' and a bunch of songs that were relatively mediocre filler songs still would have sold, you know, 2 million copies. There's no question. I mean, those songs are, you know, that song alone is just one of those ones that just will live forever. It's just a great riff, great song, great video, by the way. It just all kind of works so well for them.
Yeah, Photograph is an insanely great pop single. Kind of a more simplistic song, maybe, but I mean, yeah, you know, this one, Photograph, is a lot more about the melody than like the riffs.
Yeah, right.
It's just all melody. And if you're going to write a pop metal song, you couldn't do a better job.
Mm-mm.
Also, I was thinking, considering how many times in my life I have heard this song, I'm not one bit sick of it. I'm not sick of it at all. I'll listen to it anytime. And I've probably heard it more than almost any other song. Maybe in my entire life, but yeah, not sick of it at all. I don't think I would ever get sick of it, so... Yeah, it's an amazing piece of work, and, you know, an obvious... I guess it was kind of different at the time. It seems like an obvious hit song now, but... I mean, I don't think when they were recording Photograph, they really could have been sure what was going to happen with it. They must have known they had something, but
to me, it came on the radio. I remember it distinctly. I was telling you before we started that I used to listen to this album in the car with my girlfriend back then. It was, you know, the riff just came right out of the speakers, and that drum beat. You just want to, you know, once that drum beat, it's just almost you can't help but want to turn it up really, really loud. And it's just, yeah, it's just one of those. It's one of the ones too that you could probably go through and listen to all the different piece parts of it and think about how Lang and those guys built that song. There are all these little changes along the way. These things, you know, the outro with the I won't try to imitate Joe Elliott's vocal melody on the outro when he does that, when they're trading, he's trading off with the guitar on the outro. It's just all put together so well, and you get the impression that it was all carefully mapped out. What, how many millions of dollars did they go into debt for this? Is it true, £1 million or $1 million? I can't remember the figure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and the thought process, I can imagine, at the record company would have been very different if Lang didn't have the AC/DC album in his back pocket and the, you know, High and Dry, and, you know, where you can sort of imagine that at Mercury that they were like, okay, we trust this guy to make this record, you know, because it's, you know, I can imagine you have this rock band and you're making this sort of album that's taking months and months, and you know, you're thinking, it's just two guitars, drums and bass, let's just, you know, vocals, let's get it done, you know, boys. But they obviously, the record company trusted Lang to be able to run up that kind of debt, because that's a, I'll tell you what, I mean, I can only imagine that the vice presidents must have been, and the executives at the company must be getting these bills in the mail and thinking, my God, what are they doing in that studio?
Yeah, there, when they were making this album, there was no way to know it was going to work or it was going to cross over. There was, yeah, so they took a chance, but I mean, obviously they knew they had something here with a song like Photograph. And moving on to the next song, Stage Fright, you know, I love it. This one, I talked on the High and Dry episode about how a lot of the songs have like a menacing build. They just build, and they go kind of from ominous to aggressive. And this song has that arrangement, but I think the production really undermines that dynamic. And Mutt's approach on a song like this just wasn't appropriate. That being said, I love this song. I've always loved it. I'm not complaining about it, but also, in retrospect, I don't think the way Mutt approached this song was necessarily the right way to do it, but it's still great, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say earlier, too, and I can imagine their managers are listening to the, along the way, the managers are listening to these roughs of the album, and I think it was Peter Mensch who said something like, Mutt Lang would come, or the guys in the band would come, and they'd have a cassette, and they'd say, this is what we have done so far. It's 6 months into the process, and he'd be like listening back to the tape from 5 months ago, and he can't tell the difference. He's like, I don't think, right. It's like literally like one word is different or something. Yeah. Like they've changed one, you know, one word or one phrase of the guitar solo. And so, yeah, these along the way, these songs, it just, the keyboards, again, I think that's where, for me, maybe a little bit too much. It sounds a little bit more dated than High and Dry does, as you pointed out. And of course, you know, Hysteria is almost a totally different beast, where all that stuff, we can, you know, I don't want to get into Hysteria in great detail, but all that stuff almost sort of sees part and parcel of what it is. It's just, no matter how electronic it sounds, it's all, that was what Def Leppard was making this incredibly electronic album, where this sort of is kind of caught in the middle between the more raw Thin Lizzy, Led Zeppelin type of new wave of British heavy metal approach that they came out of versus this electronically sweetened band that they are becoming.
Yeah, I think my complaint with the way like Stage Fright is produced is that it's kind of muddied, and there's not enough separation between the instruments, and so, you know, on High and Dry, it just sounds so great, and it just sounds like it's approached in more of a, it's more of a basic approach, but it just sounds perfect. Mm-hmm. And this, a song like Stage Fright on here, there's just too much going on, and I think some of the elements of the song just kind of get lost in the background or something like that. I think a big problem is, yeah, just thinking too much and trying, just putting too much thought into it and too much tinkering, like you're saying. And then, you know, tinker, and then you can't really tell the difference. So maybe at some point they should have stripped it back and said, well, maybe there's too much going on here, as opposed to just piling more on, you know.
And that brings us to Too Late for Love, which I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry here, and it calls it a power ballad, which I'm not sure. I don't know. I just it doesn't – what do you think? Do you think it's a power ballad?
No. No, I actually wrote down that I guess it's a ballad, but I don't really think of it as a ballad. I guess for this record, this is the ballad, but yeah, it's not really a ballad.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like that to me. It just, when I was listening to the record, one of the things I was struck with is that their songwriting approach still has that Zeppelin-esque aspects of kind of building pieces on top of each other, sort of the way Page did on Led Zeppelin 4 or on Presence, the guitar armies in sort of ways, as, you know, the acoustic, the electric, gets you to the chorus. And again, I'm not suggesting that this song sounds quote unquote like Zeppelin. It really doesn't, but they just had this way of orchestrating their parts. And yeah, I mean, I don't hear it as maybe that's just my historical distortion looking back from the late 80s and what power ballads became. I would not call this a power ballad. I need to edit this Wikipedia page immediately. Delete it out.
No, it's not a power ballad. It might be like a heavy metal ballad, but it's more that it has that kind of soft, loud dynamic that they did a lot on High and Dry too, where it starts out mellow and then it gets heavier.
Sure.
But yeah, just because it has a mellow part that goes into a heavier part doesn't make it a ballad. But I guess it is a little slower paced, and it's not as aggressive or whatever as Stage Fright, but yeah, power ballad, no.
We'll be right back.
At first, I was thinking, I wish I had a count of how many times I've listened to this album in my life, but then I thought, well, maybe I don't want to know that number. I think it would be a huge number.
Like on your iTunes, yeah, and you can look and see how many times you played it, yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely one of my most listened to albums of my teenage years, and so a song like this, I still know every single second of it by heart. You know, I adore this song, really love it.
There was when I did a couple article reads before we got together today, one of the things I read is that the album was selling in August, it sold 100,000 copies a week in the United States at one point in August, which I find incredibly hard to believe.
Yeah, it went to number two on the charts in May, and the only reason it didn't go to number one was because of Thriller. But it only made it to number 18 in the UK. But yeah, within a year of coming out, it had sold 6 million copies. And also, On Through the Night went gold, and High and Dry went platinum in that time just because of the success of Pyromania. So yeah, it was a massive, massive album.
By the end of the 80s, I read it had sold 9 million copies.
Right. And a huge part of that was MTV. MTV played a huge role in that.
Yeah. And, you know, those videos, which now are fairly absurd for me to watch. You know, I don't know how many videos from 1983, 1984 era hold up all that well anymore. But they were just played. If you weren't around, if you're younger than us and you weren't around back then, it was one of those things that there was a Def Leppard song seemingly played that year, every hour, it seemed like there was a Def Leppard song of one of the videos was being played. That's how it was, just in constant, constant heavy rotation.
Yeah, and all three of the videos looked pretty similar.
Yeah.
Like if you just started one up in the middle with the sound off, you wouldn't know which one it was.
Right.
So those first four songs, to me, it doesn't really get much better than that. All four of those songs are amazing for me. I just absolutely love them. And then we get to the last song on side one, and at this point, this song dips from the quality of the first four, in my opinion. I still like it, but it's not as good as those first four songs. Do you think this song is a little bit pretentious or something, maybe?
I don't know. The thing I was kind of struck by was that Lang ended the two sides with these longer songs, which is interesting too.
It's both songs have kind of a similar feel. I put them together.
Billy Gotta Gun and Die Hard Hunter.
Yeah, they go together for me as kind of a pair.
I would love to have known the genesis of that, whether whether that was the band or Lang that wanted the songs to be longer, because you would at first glance think, oh, he's probably going to want to keep everything shorter. You know, 3-4 minute songs that are much more of these easy to digest pop tunes, where these two songs were a little bit longer. I'd love to talk to Joe Elliott or any of the other guys in the band if they can remember how those pieces came together to write a song where my first impulse would be to think that as a producer, he'd be like, no, we got to cut this verse out, or we have to chop this beat part out. Let's get rid of this. We need to tighten this up. But he seemed to be letting them just kind of stretch it out a little bit, maybe as a nod to their roots.
And I read this song was inspired by The Deer Hunter, which I guess, loosely maybe inspired by that, or just the basic germ of the idea of the subject matter, I guess, came from that, supposedly.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, and this is one of the songs on Pyromania that maybe has the most foreshadowing of what was to come, at least with like the production and the arrangements of some of the songs. Like this song, you can hear like Gods of War coming from this kind of a song more.
Yeah.
So I guess we both agree that Die Hard the Hunter, while good, it doesn't measure up to the rest of the songs inside one.
I mean, part of me feels like that's, you know, is when you have like Rock Till You Drop and Photograph, I kind of feel like the bar is so incredibly high. But yeah, I mean, there aren't, to me, when I listened in the last few days to the album, I didn't feel that sort of fast forward need, you know, which was, I think, a testament to how great the record is. When I was listening to it, I kept thinking to myself, I understand why this has sold so many copies. I understand why it was so popular, because this song quality, I don't feel like that's a filler song. So
no, I agree. This is definitely a record to listen to all the way through. But when you're, and it's not fair to compare it to those first four songs.
And I agree. I mean, I think too, like, it's not as good of a song as Stage Fright at Too Late for Love. And it's nowhere near as good of a song as Rock Road to You Drop a Photograph. But again, I would be sure to say the reason why I would say that is obviously those first two songs especially are so, you know, they're just so incredibly great.
Yeah. And speaking of incredibly great, we get to the first song on side two, Foolin', which I don't know if I have a favorite song on this record, but, you know, this would be a contender. Supposedly it was based on a Steve Clark idea. I don't know if his name is first. And this is one of those videos you were talking about. And I think this was the third single. I think Rock of Ages was second. But I love this song so much. It's just an amazing and a really original song. You know, this very different for this kind of a band at this time. You know, this is not a typical song at all.
Well, the textures between the acoustic and the electric. I think the thing that Lang probably did better on this record than maybe on Hysteria is dynamics. I always feel everything on Hysteria is always so loud. Just there's not a lot of quiet parts, and even, you know, the quiet parts, for example, on like Gods of War and Hysteria are not really that quiet. Where the acoustic guitar, the way it starts out and then builds with the vocal hook, which is absolutely irresistible. The guitar, the electric guitar riff, it's just, and then the outro with the, Am I Fooling Myself over and over again. There's all these parts that you can tell were not only carefully crafted, but also very, very skillful songwriting by these guys to come up with these different pieces along the way, where there's always something new along the way to keep the interest of the listener, where you can go all the way through. You're waiting for that part at the end, the Am I Fooling Yourself? At least I am. I love that part, and then it gets, you know, gets that little acoustic flourish there at the end.
Yeah, and as we were talking, I was thinking, if you're going to call Too Late for Love a ballad, you could pretty much call this song a ballad too, because it's got a pretty similar arrangement and dynamic, you know? I don't think Too Late for Love is much more of a ballad than this song, so I think that would be one way to say, no, Too Late for Love's not a ballad, because if you put it in perspective and you look at a song like Foolin', well, it's got the same dynamics that would cause you to think of Too Late for Love as a ballad, pretty much.
Yeah, actually, I think this, you know, in terms of power ballad, I think actually Foolin' does is more of a, to me, sounds more like a power ballad.
Yeah.
So you and I need to edit Wikipedia and swap that out, because that's wrong.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Yeah. But it's not a ballad. But if you're going to call Too Late for Love one, then you could apply the same thought process to this one. And it's funny, this song only made it to number 28 on Billboard, which is crazy. It's funny, the singles, I think they were, like we were talking about MTV, they were bigger on MTV than they were just as a single, you know?
I would love to know the count. Of course, that's probably an impossible thing to find out, but that whether Foolin' or Photograph got played more in that 83-84 era, I probably think Photograph did, but Foolin' was on all the time. It was just on constantly.
Yeah. And I just think the best way to describe this song is cool. It's just really cool. And And it again, as many times as I've heard it, I'll never be sick of it. Which I probably couldn't say of the next song. The next song, Rock of Ages, the opening riff from Steve Clark. I would say it is catchy, but... And they say Mutt Lange wanted a crowd participation song.
He got it.
Yeah. Of course, the hilarious intro, that's Mutt Lange saying that. But in the video, Peter Mensch is the one mouthing it, I guess. Joe Elliott called this song a 3-minute lump of fun. You know, to me, this is a precursor to Pour Some Sugar on Me, really. So this song, in retrospect, was kind of a bad omen in way of things to come.
Yeah.
And huge departure, especially from like High and Dry. I don't hate Rock of Ages, but it's definitely not one of my favorites. That's for sure.
There's one thing irks me when I listen to it. It's the effects on the bass. It just, you know, that during the verse where he's that bass sound, as I don't know what the effect is on it, but
yeah
I think you're exactly right to say this is the kind of the, there's one song that's the bridge between this one and Hysteria more than anyone else. I think it's Rock of Ages that does that work to sort of say, yeah, you can imagine this is what was going to be the kind of the starting point for the next record. It's another song that was played continually on MTV. It just screams my childhood, because it was just I know I'm repeating myself, but it just was continually on the radio. It was just, the album was so huge. It's in the wake of Hysteria, I have to tell you that because I always associated Stereo with being the huge Def Leppard record, because that was something that the album that seemed to have like legs for like 2.5 years. It just seemed to go on forever. But it's easy to forget how just massive this record was. And to have those two albums back to back is incredible. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and Hysteria had kind of a slow build, mm-hmm. which it kind of dragged out its success, I guess. I don't know about you, but I was not aware of Def Leppard when Pyromania first came out. I was only 9 years old when it came out. I got into Def Leppard in between Pyromania and Hysteria, but I don't have the perspective of a person who liked Def Leppard before Pyromania came out, but I can only imagine a person who was a Def Leppard fan and got Pyromania like right when it came out, and when they got to this song, a lot of people must have been like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, yeah. If you were an early adopter of Def Leppard, it was a fairly sharp and quick turn from the first few. I mean, this, you know, from where they first appear in America, and then like you're saying, High and Dry is such a great sort of straightforward rock record, and to come to this, yeah, it's, and then you get to Hysteria, but you know, they took that risk and broadened their fan base. Whereas in other cases, I think, you know, if you look at what Priest did with Turbo, I'm not sure that broadened their fan base. I don't think. Maybe it did, but it just sort of alienated their other fans, and then gave them this short term MTV success that didn't necessarily pay off. Whereas with Def Leppard, I think it's kind of hard to say this didn't all pay off in the end, because they became one of these bands that transcended the 80s because of these records.
Yeah, I like Turbo a lot personally, but it definitely didn't translate to the crossover type audience. Yeah, Rock of Ages, you know, like Joliet says, 3-minute lump of fun. You can't take it too seriously. It is catchy. So I don't have a serious issue with this song, but it's, you know, there's a certain approach they're taking here that I'm not completely on board with. But then again, you know, it's not horrible. So I don't, but you know, that's not the greatest thing you could say about a song, is that it's not horrible. But
yeah, just in the context of the whole record, it's easy to maybe single it out and say, yeah, I the excesses are there, but yeah, it's still a good, I mean, it's still a good song. You know, it's still one of those ones that I can't help but sort of enjoy when I listen to it, even though I may not go and listen to it all the time.
Yeah, but then if you compare it to Foolin', it's kind of sad at the same moment, at least for me. Then we get to the next song, Coming Under Fire. I've always loved this song. I read that this must have been in Julian Gill's book, Leppard Tracks. He said Rolling Stone described this song as Boston on overdrive.
Yeah. Yeah. In re-listening to the record, I was really struck by how the last three songs, I mean, we can talk about Billy Got a Gun. Billy's Got a Gun maybe less than the other two, but there's almost, you're expecting the letdown in terms of the song quality. And they're really, I mean, these are good. I think they're good songs. I mean, that's the thing. I'd love to hear what you think, but to me, the way it sort of, the album rides out on these three songs, you just think, wow, they really delivered. They really came through with a great record from front to back.
Yeah, as far as just the song structure, I think Coming Under Fire might be the closest to High and Dry that this record comes. And so this is another one where I really wish I could hear this recorded and put together like High and Dry was. And this would have fit really well on High and Dry, I think. It would have been probably a little heavier, but yeah, like I said, it would fit really well on High and Dry, and I love this song. The "Oh, I Want to Make It" line might be a little bit cringe-inducing.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, it's great.
I was going to say about Action Not Words, I was trying to listen for the glam influence, the glitter rock influence. And to me, this is the one more, maybe more than any of the others, with the chorus, the action, you know, sort of could be like a Sweet song or something like that. I could imagine where Sweet could have done something along those lines with that type of that chorus. I don't know what you think about that, but
What you're saying. Yeah.
You know, I don't hear as much as Elliot always talks about, and those guys talk about how important Bowie and Gary Glitter and the Sweet, where all these bands were to their musical education along the way. And this is the one more than any of them I can kind of hear that being sort of reworked as I said, like a song from that, like a Slade song or something like that, maybe, in sort of a rewrite.
Yeah, Action Not Words is a fun song. Definitely, I think, the easiest song on the record. Like, this is the one that they don't have to put much effort into it to come up with this song. I think if you compare it to like the first four songs on the album, it doesn't compare. But that's not fair. You know, it's still a really fun song, but I it would be one of my least favorites on the album. But, you know, that's not a criticism, because look at the quality of this album. Yeah, so the record closes out with Billy's Got a Gun, which is a good album closer. And we've already talked about it a little bit, comparing it to Die Hard the Hunter. Joe Elliott has suggested it was inspired by the movie Death Wish, which... yeah, I like this more than Die Hard the Hunter, personally. There's a lot of great melodies.
And obviously the massive Zeppelin influence all over it. You know, there's a Steve Clark with the right on that one, right? He wrote that one. And it's yeah, to me, that's the most obvious. I mean, there's lots of nods to Zeppelin, but to me, that riff and that beginning of that song is the most obvious nod to Zeppelin on the whole record.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a big arrangement on this song, and there's a lot of different parts, lots of melodies, lots of cool guitar work. So yeah, it's a good way to close out the album because it has sort of an epic feel, I guess.
This one's called Billy's Got a Gun. We'll be right back.
So in the end, as much as I love this record as a cohesive piece of work, I don't like it quite as much as High and Dry, but still one of my favorite albums of all time, personally. Where does it rank for you?
You know, it's one of those records that I said to you off the air, I think. I don't listen to it on a regular basis, but it's very easy and familiar, in part because it was played so much, but also it was just one of those, as a kid, it was one of those tapes. If you had a friends who were into pop metal, for lack of a better term, it was almost always in the car. You know, it was one of those, almost put in Pyromania. We listened to it all the time. So I have a very nostalgic view of it, even if I'm not a guy who's going to pull out Pyromania and throw it on the stereo and listen on a regular basis. It's almost like a comfort food for me. So I really enjoy listening to it, and I listened to it differently this time because I was more focused on maybe some of the 80s flourishes that Lang had put on the record. And I think, again, that sort of listening to that now, I can hear how that I would, like you, maybe prefer some of that stuff to be dialed back. To listen to it now, yeah, it brings back lots of good memories. And I always think it's a great, if you're interested in sort of understanding what was great about 80s hard rock / heavy metal, I mean, this is one of the records I'd want to hand somebody who's, you know, 15 now and say, you know, all that music sucked, and say, well, listen to this, you know, this is, and listen to the songs. And I think it's one of those ones that's very easy to kind of to embrace, even if the musical style maybe to you is not a familiar one.
Yeah, that's a great analogy you made about comfort food. I have a lot of records like that where there's a lot of times where you just feel like putting that album on that you loved when you were a kid. There's just a lot of times where I want to reach for one of those records, and this is definitely one of them for sure.
And it's also one of those records, too, as we wrap up, I know, but to say, too, it's almost like, you know, I very rarely will put Led Zeppelin 4 on because I've heard the song so much. But when I do, you know, I really do enjoy listening to it. And this is the same way. It's just something that it's just – you feel like you've heard it so much. It's like the first Boston record I love. And, you know, again, I don't always feel the need to go on because I've just heard Smokin' on the radio or wherever, just on streaming or something, just yesterday or something. So I don't always feel the need to kind of go for it because I know the song so well. But, yeah, it's just one of those ones when you do put it on, you're like, oh, it brings me right back to when I was a kid. It really, really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, with each of these, starting with Pyromania, with each Def Leppard album, there's a major, major change that takes place. And so this, of course, the major change is Pete Willis is out, Phil Collin is in, and the Phil Collin makes his live debut with the band in February of 1983 at the Marquee Club. And then they went on a two-month UK tour, and then as Pyromania is taking off, they start touring the U.S. opening for Billy Squire. And from everything I've read, they were just blowing him off the stage. I mean, that really was not fair in 1983 for Billy Squire to have to follow Def Leppard.
Yeah, I know what's incredible to me is that to think that's where they started. You know, I'm not the guy who has the best sense about Def Leppard's growth in America. But yeah, I mean, Squire was huge at the time. So it's... And he's sort of at that moment where his career is going to start to decline.
Yeah, he was going to be on the decline very quickly.
I may have told you the story. I'll tell very quickly that in 1984 about Billy Squire, a little detour here. I was very excited because it was going to be Rat and Billy Squire at Nassau Coliseum. I want to say it was like September of 1984. And by the time Billy Squire gets to Long Island to play that show, Rat's off the tour because Squire's career is going downhill. And it's I got to see Molly Hatchet, which I actually don't regret having seen Molly Hatchet. But yeah, sort of I can imagine that Billy Squire sort of was seeing this all happening where these opening acts are supplanting him. You know, Rat's getting bigger than Billy Squire for that moment in time. Def Leppard certainly was like leaving him in the absolute dust, you know?
Yeah, well, by April of 83, I think Def Leppard were headlining in the U.S. So, and then it was May is when the album went to number two, and you know they were just off to the races. Then.
Wow!
I wanted to talk to you a little bit then about moving into 1984 because when I was reading about this, so late 1984, they're already thinking about starting to work on their next record, and Mutt Lange was not available when they were ready to start recording, and it looks like the first person they were considering was Ted Templeman.
No kidding.
To produce the next record. Yeah, but they say that Ted Templeman wanted too much money to do it. So it looks like they were pretty close to working with him.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't think Ted will mind me telling this story. He told me a story. We were having a conversation about Van Halen, about Rod Stewart and Rod Stewart wanted to produce one of his records. So again, I don't know when this would be. I would imagine this would be early to mid 80s. I'm just guessing. And that Rod's manager, maybe it was the late 70s, but Rod's manager basically wanted Ted to get no money. And so Ted was like, no. So I think it was all part of the negotiations. I mean, who knows how it all shakes out and with the points and everything. But I think, yeah, when you're thinking, you know, you give someone a point or not a point on the record, however those negotiations worked out, I can imagine you're thinking like, yeah, we're talking big money. I mean, it's like millions and millions of dollars when you're selling that many records. It's not like, who cares? It's $100,000, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to read the saga of how they were trying to find a producer when Mutt Lange wasn't available. They approached Phil Collins, but he was busy producing Eric Clapton's album Behind the Sun. But I was thinking, so then you would have had Phil Collins producing Phil Collin.
so the follow up to Hysteria, they considered Templeman and
Pyromania.
Phil
yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. So this would have been Hysteria.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would have been a very different...
Changed. I imagine history would have been changed if either of those guys. And then, you know, Templeman and Lenny Waronker do stuff on Clapton's record. They do the three of the songs, you know, Forever Man and a couple of other songs. So it ends up that Collins and Templeman end up doing the Clapton
record. Oh, really?
Record. Yeah, Lenny do that record, yeah. That's very, very interesting, yeah, to think about it. You know, I think... Yeah, can you imagine how different it would have sounded? There, you know, it's not a matter of like you get like your regular hard rock producer. You know, Lang had such a particular vision and Templeman did too. I think it would have been so, you know, considering what they were headed for and what they were doing, rock history would have been changed forever. That's funny.
Yeah, that's well, great. And then there's the really famous, they ended up with Jim Steinman for I don't know how many months. They recorded like 8 or 9 songs with Jim Steinman before they scrapped it. And from what I read, they, you know, Jim Steinman just wasn't really doing much except saying like, "Yeah, sounds good." And they missed having Mutt Lange's, you know, obsessive participation.
Yeah.
I guess.
Whereas, you know, from what I know, the little bit I know about Phil Collins, you know, I think he was very much a song guy. You know, where he worked with Clapton and those songs on. I actually really like Behind the Sun quite a bit, and I think those songs were definitely Phil Collins was not a guy like was just like pushing the, you know, pushing the talk back button and said, sounds great, Eric, you know, good job, and just like move on to the next take. He was definitely into it. So yeah, imagine it would have sounded like Genesis Invisible Touch or something.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, you know, maybe that wouldn't have been, the electronics would have definitely been there if Phil Collins recorded it, no doubt about it.
Well, 1984, the Van Halen album came out on New Year's Eve, right? So by the time late 1984, when they're looking at Ted Templeman, that was like the biggest record in the whole world, probably, right?
Yeah, and you had, you had the Aerosmith record was in the pipeline, I think, right? Because Done with Mirrors was not done yet, or had not come out yet.
Oh, right, yeah.
That was in the pipeline. I'm sure his phone was ringing off the hook after 1984.
So I guess that's the perspective you have to look at is when they're looking at possibly working with Ted Templeman, that's right when 1984, the Van Halen record, is massive. So,
and of course, the interesting thing is, from what I understand, some of the more electronic flourishes on the keyboards, the synth drums, were not things that Templeman embraced. That there were not things that he would have, if he had had the final say in everything, that he would have gone with. I think that was just the way the guys were going in the band, and he was, he was not as enthusiastic about the electronic drums and some of the other stuff. I think there was a lot of debate about Jump and how Jump should sound and what the band should do in terms of direction. I think that I think that was Eddie and Don Landy particularly, and probably Alex were the guys more than anyone else who were sort of trying to work that new sound into the. Alex particularly loved the electronic drums, apparently, because they couldn't put the full drum kit into 5150 at the time. So, yeah, all these – that record. And so you can kind of hear, maybe how that little genesis of – sorry to go back to Phil Collins with the pun there, but the little the seed of something there. Maybe those guys heard 1984 and said, yeah, he could be the guy who would take us in another direction. And they might have gotten in the pre-production with him, and he would have been like, we don't want – I don't want any of this crap. I want it to sound like High and Dry, which I'm going to guess that's probably what would have happened. He would have tried to make it sound like High and Dry more than anything else.
Sounds good to me.
Well, there you go. History.
Yeah. So that's – it's pretty interesting to imagine the alternate reality where they came up with a record in, 85 instead of 87 that was produced by Ted Templeman, and then – what would happen after that. But it wasn't to be. The saga, I guess. So on the next episode, we'll talk about, I'm going to have Joey Haney on from Rock Strikes 10 to talk about the saga of Hysteria.
Great.
Yeah. So thanks a lot, Greg, for talking to me about Pyromania. And, I don't know how many episodes this is that you've been on, but you have an open invitation to come back anytime. So,
hey, I love it. I love talking about this stuff with you. So we'll do when you have another series coming up. I'd be happy to. I have a good Iron Maiden story. If you ever decide to do anything with Iron Maiden, I've got lots of stuff to talk about. So yeah.
And now to play us out.
What does that mean? To play us out? I don't know what that means. To play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with, I think, the perfect segue between this week's episode about Pyromania and next week's episode about Hysteria. We're going to hear what is apparently the first song that the band wrote and recorded post-Pyromania, at the very beginning of the Hysteria sessions. This song was written by Rick Savage and Joe Elliott around February of 1984. And the recording we're going to hear, there's an intro, this is on the Retroactive album, and there's an intro part that was new, that was recorded in the early 90s, but I cut that part off. We're just going to hear the end section, which, according to Joe Elliott, quoted in Julian Gill's book, Leopard Tracks, this is Joe Elliott speaking, "Everything from when the song gets heavy right through to the end is the original backing track and recording, the vocal and everything, from December of 1984 in Holland." So this is Def Leppard right after the huge success of Pyromania, right at the beginning of the saga that would be the creation of the Hysteria record. And this is what they sounded like in 1984, right when they were beginning to try to figure out what they were going to do next. This is Fractured Love. Till next time.
I'm caught in.
I'll be back.